morning, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the ID Element, all about the release candidate of Active Directory Federation Services 2, or for friends, ADFS 2.0. I'm here with Matt Steele, senior PM of the ADFS team, who already appeared on the show and gave you the good news about Beta 2. So it seemed only fitting to have him to relay the news about RC. Hey Matt, how's it going?
It's going great.
Thank you for having us. Matt, what's the new and notable about this RC release of ADFS?
There's a lot of new stuff we've worked on. Probably one of the most notable and something that we've always prioritized in our group is interoperability work that we've done over the course of our RC milestone. You may have read in the news that we actually got Liberty Alliance conformance level testing 100% approval on the identity provider light, service provider light, and eGov 1.5 profiles. So basically that means that we and a bunch of vendors got together and we went out there and they tested our SAML protocol implementation. And they found it to be conformant across a whole bevy of test cases. So the whole team was really, really excited about that. That means that now we can, you know, advertise like we've always wanted to, that AFS 2.0 implements the SAML protocol, and we're interoperable with all these vendors across all these test cases. Now, in Beta 2, we'd actually, you know, just moved forward in putting together a lot of the SAML protocol work, but we weren't quite as polished as we've gotten over the course of RC. So, over the course of RC, we've added in a lot of features for SAML, both on the IDP Lite side, SP Lite side, features like IDP-initiated authentication, some of the single logout capabilities that SAML protocol has that mirror what we had in on the WS Federation side. Also, some cool features like the artifact resolution protocol and the replay detection that we can now do. So there's a lot of work that's happened there. And we've also gone to sort of a variety of interop fests over the course of our RC milestone and vetted that out on the SAML side and on our other protocols like WS Trust and WS Federation. So over the last, you know, 5 months or so since Beta 2 came out, we've done a lot of interoperability work, and that's been pretty core for the RC. So that's really exciting, and that's one of the things we want to sort of sing from the hilltop the most, is that you can use ADFS, you can interop with other vendors that support SAML protocol, WS Federation, identity selectors that, in addition to card space, things like, I think we've been looking into a variety of other identity selectors there. But that's really exciting. The other thing that we put the most effort into, probably over the whole milestone, is the user experience for deployments. So, you know, we've talked to a lot of our customers, and we found that the whole space, you know, claims, everything, it can be a little bit complicated to achieve the goals that you want. And one of the things we wanted to do throughout this RC as we started to polish the product is let's take all the noise away from this space, from establishing federations and from getting interoperability across identity. So one of the places we looked at and we knew we could take away some of the noise was in deploying the product. We know all of our prerequisites, and we know everything that needs to be set up in terms of getting you to a running, you know, Active Directory Federation service. So what we've done is we've revamped a lot of our setup and initial configuration to make that just drop dead easy. And that's really exciting. So right now our setup will do things like automatically pull in prerequisites. So you get a Server 2008 box and you put on .NET 3.5. And then beyond that, our setup, when you launch our setup, is actually going to find all the prerequisites, automatically put on things like WIF, Windows Identity Foundation, so you don't have to worry about that as an IT pro anymore. Automatically make sure that features like WID and PowerShell are installed. And it's going to go through all of that and then leave you with a system that's ready to go. And you also now get to choose between whether you're installing a server for like your internet deployment of ADFS, or if you're installing a proxy. So if you actually have a perimeter network and you want users to be able to authenticate from the internet through that perimeter network, you can install an ADFS proxy out there. In Beta 2, you could do that as well, but you had to go and look at our docs and you had to understand a deployment script and how to do that. In this release, in RC, you can actually choose that you want to install a proxy, and we'll guide you through in a wizard format how to deploy that proxy and get the trust set up between the proxy and that back-end server. On the back-end server side, you know, again, one of the things we wanted to make really easy was setting up something highly available. I mean, we're an authentication service. We're very similar to Active Directory, Kerberos, NTLM, all those kinds of authentication protocols you're familiar with on Windows Server. So if you're using us for authentication, we're protecting a whole bunch of applications. We know that we're a really, really critical service. You can't just have ADFS go down and have access to all these applications continue because they have something else protecting them. So we wanted to make it really easy to set up something that's highly available. And our general solution for that is a farm. And so standard kind of web farm, we're very similar to a web app in terms of our architecture. And so we wanted to make it easy to set up multiple hardware instances of ADFS representing a single logical federation service. So you can scale out to anticipate a higher load as you start adding in additional applications with different load characteristics. And you can also use that to deal with hardware failures that occur. So you have your load balancer just, you know, ah, this machine isn't responding. I'm just going to take it out of the round robin of the deployment. And so that's a little bit easier said than done. You know, one of the things that we said was we really want to make this easy, but in previous versions with Beta 2, you know, you had to set up SQL, and you had to set up your connection string into SQL. And so one of the things we worked on, and we're a component of Windows, so we should be able to do this, is leveraging the Windows component, Windows internal database. So we call it WID for short. So we wanted people, instead of having to deploy, you know, even with SQL Express, that's another prereq that can kind of be some noise in the way of deploying your federation service. So we wanted to get rid of that. And we can enable WID on the system. We can put in our configuration into WID. The one thing that's a challenge there is as you start to want to put multiple federation servers together to represent a single federation service, it might be more interesting if I can actually whiteboard it here. So, you know, the classic web farm multiple instance scale out story is something like this, and we'll say that we have like a load balancer up here. So requests come into here and they get round robined, you know, to the various front end instances. And those of you who are familiar with Beta 2, you ended up setting up a SQL backend here that got used for every request. So these are all, I'm going to say FS1, FS2, and these are basically our front-end servers. And so, like I was saying before, you know, if this guy goes out, the load balancer can typically detect that and take it out of the rotation, and these guys continue to handle the load. And so, we'll, as we get closer to RTM, we'll have all kinds of capacity planning guidance and things like that so you can understand, well, how many federation servers do I need to have for how much load and whatnot. But in terms of facilitating a deployment like this, we realized that for some enterprises, you know, they have managed SQL, they can stand up an instance, and it's no problem at all. But for a lot of other enterprises, they either don't have a DB admin on hand, or it's kind of a nightmare to go through their approval process to get this going. And so if they wanted to get this going and not have this, then what we needed to do was to put a configuration database in each of these guys. And so with ADFS v1, we had something similar to this with a file, but you ran into all kinds of problems of keeping that in sync across all these machines. And we recommended some esoteric solutions. You could do DFSR, you could do a variety of things. But we weren't really managing and helping the admin with that. We were kind of sloughing the problem off on the admin at that point. What we've done now is we've built these to actually synchronize with each other based on a single primary where you do admin operations. So we say that this guy is the primary, and you do admin operations into this guy. If you try to do admin operations, we sort of fail gracefully on the others. We tell you, hey, you need to go over to FS1 if you need to do any kind of management operations. And then these guys, I shouldn't put that. This guy actually syncs off of this as well. And so what can happen here, you know, the scary thing whenever systems engineers sees this is that, well, what if FS1 goes down? Well, the great thing is that while these two are syncing off of this, this guy can go down, and these will continue to service requests. So while you won't be able to do management operations in terms of adding new trusts or new applications into your protection there, you continue to service all your users accessing your existing applications. So you get a warning about this as an admin. You stand up a new primary, And you can keep going, or you can promote one of these guys to be a primary so that your previous ones will continue to operate, and you can actually do admin operations on that. So by using WID and then joining all these together into one logical federation service, we made it a lot easier to stand up a highly available service. And one of the other things that people run into with ADFS, actually I should stay at the board for this, is the challenge of managing certificates. So certificates are one of those thorny problems where there's some set of people who knows nothing about them and doesn't really want to learn about them, and there's another set of people that knows everything about them and wants to specify exactly how they're used. And so dealing with those two use cases is a challenge for any product that has to deal with certificates. You know, all your products, IIS, us, other products as well. So what we've done is we said, in that case where you know exactly what you want to do with your certificates, we're going to let you do that. We're going to provide all the administrative surface area so that you can take your certificate policy statements and certificate practice statements, and you can put those into work, put the right certificates in the right places. If you don't really already have a PKI, you don't really particularly care about taking advantage of things like PKI-based revocation, you know, certificate revocation lists, OCSP, all that kind of good stuff, then we can actually generate some self-signed certificates that we'll publish in our metadata so other people can still trust those. And we're essentially, in those self-signed certificates, just taking advantage of the public key-private key pair that's in there. You know, normal certificates, you have some sort of name binding there because there's a standard naming system. Like for SSL, the standard naming system is typically DNS. We're actually just using, in these self-signed certificates, we're just using the public private key pairs, and we're publishing those in metadata so other people can trust us explicitly without having to rely on a big PKI. And so if you're a shop that doesn't have an extensive PKI and doesn't necessarily want to set one of those up to get going with ADFS, when you're first setting up ADFS as part of this deployment user experience, we'll generate a self-signed certificate and we'll put it. So let's say you're setting up your primary server here. We'll generate that full certificate here. I'll just make a little key to represent that. The problem with this is that there's a private key on this guy that really sort of needs to stay secret. I mean, there's a lot of operational concern about that staying secret because that private key is sort of the keys to the kingdom for the whole service. And what we use is we use some Microsoft technology to securely exchange that across all of these nodes based on the Windows Service Account used for these nodes. So you can configure the same Windows Service Account across all these Federation servers. And then using that and Active Directory, we're able to securely share that private key because it's encrypted specifically for those Windows Service Accounts, and it's protected that way. And so now all of these service accounts had the capability to use that key and sign requests because as we're balancing out for load, the crypto can get pretty CPU intensive, so you need to continue to scale out as your requests per second go up and things like that. So that's a whole system we built on some existing Microsoft technology and Active Directory to share that private key in a secure manner. And then furthermore, because if we've kind of abstracted this away from you, we don't want to alarm you in 2 years by saying, hey, everything's going to expire and you've got to do something you've never done before. We've actually automatically managed the rollover in a distributed fashion of these certificates so that when this certificate is about to expire in a year, as we do by default, then we'll actually new up a new certificate, distribute it across the farm, publish it in our metadata, and then after an allotted period of time, do the switchover to start signing with that certificate or start decrypting with that certificate, as the case may be. And actually, once we start signing with that certificate, because we've been publishing it in metadata and you've gotten warnings as an admin, you know that all of your partners have been able to switch over to use that new certificate. So the rollover is a very smooth one. It's not this sort of catastrophic email, call up all your partners type of event that we have right now. So the key management and the synchronization of the WID databases allows you to set up a highly available instance of ADFS without having to be an expert in SQL Server, without having to be an expert in PKI. And then beyond that, we added a wizard to help you set these things up, take you step by step through asking you for things like the SSL cert that you should probably already have from either your corporation or from a public CA authority, the Windows Service account name that you're going to use, you know, grabbing the settings from the primary WID server that we talked about before. And so right now what you can do is you can get a brand new Server 2008 box, You can put on, make sure .NET 3.5 is on there, and then you can run through ADFS setup. It'll pull in all the prereqs. You can set up a farm machine, and you'll be ready to go, and you'll be ready to set up your highly available Federation service. So that's something that, that we put a lot of work into, making sure that that user experience was very seamless, a lot of testing, usability testing as well. So we feel pretty good about that one. Rounding out what we've done, we've put in a lot of additional security features. So we know we're a security product, and we've been following things like the Microsoft Secure Development Lifecycle throughout the entire product. So we're confident that we're producing secure code. There's a lot of features that we can tack on to address specific security needs in specific situations. So, you know, an easy one to think about is like SHA-256 hashes. Those crypto experts out there know that SHA-1 is sort of going headlong into its end of life, and there's all these scary sort of, you know, SHA-1 to be broken in 2 years and things like that. So to address things like that, we support SHA-256 across the entire product, supporting both in how we sign tokens and how we do messaging at the protocol layer, etc. And we also give you the control where if you're dealing with a vendor or another product that, because its legacy doesn't understand SHA-256 and you're comfortable downgrading to SHA-1, you still have that option, because there's a variety of products out there because of where the standards are and where a variety of other things are that don't yet support SHA-256, so you can still downgrade that. Other things we did on the security front, we put together a much finer grained set of cert validation controls. So, you know, I was talking earlier about if you've got a PKI, you likely already have a set of policies and statements about how to use that PKI. So we've given you some control inside of our product as to how we validate certificates, how we check revocation on certificates, so that if you don't publish a CRL or have, say, an OCSP endpoint inside of your corporation, then you don't have to worry about that. You can disable certificate revocation checking, and we won't, you know, lock up trying to go out there and say, you know, we can't check revocation on the certificate, we should probably stop. So we have some granular controls about those, both for your client certificates and for certificates that may be used to encrypt tokens to you, or you're using to encrypt tokens to partners, or you're using to sign tokens out or check the and verify the signatures that are coming in into you. So that's another one of those security features. We got a lot of feedback over the course of Beta 2 on our auditing story. You know, right now, when you turn on auditing, we have some extra guidance about exactly how to turn on auditing for the product. And we noticed that in some cases where you're issuing a lot of claims for a user, you end up in a situation where the audit logs and the individual audits get unbelievably big, because we're putting in all the information about those claims, the URIs of the claim type, the values, the types of values we have there, the original issuers of those claim types. And we actually were able to find out that there were some situations where we'd overrun, you know, the size of a single event. So we've gone back through and sort of retooled our auditing story so that we make sure that we don't overrun events. And we play very nicely with some of the other Microsoft products that are out there, like auditing collection service, so that they can do automatic sort of computations across our audits and collecting of our audits in a useful way that we got some feedback on in Beta 2. So we've done some improvements in auditing. Probably, I mentioned replay detection earlier, so we can actually maintain a temporary cache of tokens that we've seen to make sure that, especially with bearer tokens, this can be very important, because bearer tokens just have to stay secret all the way throughout their lifetime. If you turn on replay detection, though, we maintain a cache of those tokens that we've seen, so if someone maliciously is able to get a hold of that token, which they shouldn't be able to do because it's protected by SSL the whole time, if somehow they're able to, you know, install some malware on a user's machine, get a hold of that token, and they try to replay it to us, we can detect that replay because we can say, no, we've seen that before, and we know that we shouldn't honor that that token, because we've already issued a token based on that token. So that's another one of these kind of tack-on security features that, depending on your deployment and your enterprise policies, might be sort of important. Probably the biggest one we did was the authorization story for token issuance. So previously, you'd set up a Federation service, and we would issue tokens to anyone who presented us a token from a trusted partner, or anyone who was able to authenticate into Active Directory. We got a lot of feedback from customers previously that says, you know, there's some times where I don't want to issue a token at all. I don't want to have the relying party have to enforce some access controls based on claims. I just want to cut it short right there at the STS because I know the rules of who should be going out to, say, you know, a vendor-hosted site. So inside of Microsoft, a great example of this is the eCompany Store. eCompany Store, Microsoft has very extensive policies of who gets to buy software at internal, you know, company discounts or whatever. And they don't necessarily want the eCompany Store to have to worry about implementing all of those policies because they're kind of complicated. Implementing all those policies for authorization over on their side, because that's sort of a hassle to put onto a vendor. Hey, you know, here's this complicated set of things that, oh, there's no product that does that? Well, you're just going to have to figure out how to enforce access based on these claims. So what we've done inside of AFS20RC is that we've enabled you to authorize token issuances on a per relying party basis. So you can do it per application or per, you know, sort of resource partner that you're going out to. And you can basically make a decision based on the claims of the user using the same rich claims language that we debuted in Beta 2. So it's not just an ACL editor in terms of enabling you to say, you know, everybody in the domain admins group can go out to this this purchasing application. Of course, we can say things like that, but we can say much richer things like, if you're a program manager and your eyes are blue and your shoe size is 41, then you can actually go out and go to this site. And obviously, that's not a very realistic scenario, but you can imagine that by combining claims-based access control in this on particular relying parties, you can actually achieve some really interesting use cases. You can do some of these attribute-based access control, role-based access control, claims-based access control scenarios that we've been talking a long time about being able to use your title combined with your membership on a virtual project combined with your membership in an AD security group to determine whether you should have access to something. And that's been a real boon for MSIT. They can enforce some of these policies without having to construct this really, you know, rich taxonomy of groups. They can just say, hey, you know, if you're have these attributes in AD, then you have access, otherwise you don't. So the neat thing there is you can leverage all the parts of the claims language. Notably, the things we introduced in Beta 2 about going out to attribute stores. So if you've got a SQL attribute store in your enterprise that stores sets of roles or sets of permissions, you can use that as part of the access control decision to either permit or deny. And we can do things where you say, permit all users except deny Vittorio because I don't trust that guy. So we can do exceptions to lists and things like that. And I'm sure a lot of authorization guys are asking, well, wait, what are the rules about that? You know, deny always overrides. So if you don't get a permit, it's deny overrides and deny by default. So if I'm trying to come into the system and there's no permit generated for me, obviously I'm denied. If a permit is generated for me and a deny is generated for me, we model this in terms of claims, obviously, we're the claims team. Then if both of these things are generated, then the deny always overrides the permit. So that you're always safe. You know, you're never giving access when you didn't mean to. So that authorization feature is now on every relying party that you'll see, every relying party trust that you'll see inside of AEFS. So you can always go in. And we help people to, you know, if you really don't care about who's going to this relying party and you just want to let the relying party do it, you know, as you're setting things up in the wizard, we give you an option. Hey, do you want to just permit all users or do you want to author your own more complex authorization policy? So there's still sort of a get-out-of-jail-free card if you're not up for writing a more complicated policy. We've also put together a set of rule templates. You're probably familiar with some of the rule templates from Beta 2. A set of rule templates to basically say, if the user has this claim type with this value, then permit them. So I can say, if a user has group with value domain admins, then permit. Or if the user has group, foreign nationals, then deny, or something along those lines. So we can help you through that process. And then, just like in Beta 2, you can always fall back on the whole claims language if you want to author some of these more complex, requiring multiple claims or going out to SQL attribute stores to decide on whether the user has access. One of the things we did that kind of brings me to another thing we did in RC, which is that we looked at the rule editing experience that we put out in Beta 2, and we saw that there was some noise there in terms of the user experience that you saw. That we could actually simplify and only present you a few concepts at once. So now when you're creating rules, you're going to get a wizard-like experience where we're describing what each rule template can do for you, why you would choose that rule template, why you might want to choose a different rule template in particular scenarios, and then as you're going through, helping you to see the fields that you need to fill in and get simple validation on those fields when you click finish in the wizard. So now we have that wizard-like experience to help you know exactly what kind of rule you want to create, how you might want to chain that rule with other rules, and you're not presented with a lot of other details at the same time. So when you're creating a rule, all you're worried about is creating that rule. You're not looking at all the other rules and how they might have to interact. So you can click finish on that, and you'll then see your list of rules. Another piece of feedback we got from Beta 2 is that a lot of admins, when they're constructing a rule, wanted to be able to name that and describe it in their own language. So while we could probably come up with some automated way to describe what a rule is doing, you know, all the admins kind of want to say, this is my rule for groups, because I know how I handle groups. I just want to call it my groups rule or whatever. And so now when you're looking at your list of rules, you'll see the admin specified names for those rules. So as an admin, when you're coming back to that, you can easily pick up on, that's right, that's the rule that I wrote that that enforces that, you know, only people with a level greater than 59 can get into this site or whatever else. And likewise, you can characterize that in English as opposed to or whatever your native language is, as opposed to relying on some sort of machine-generated description that might not capture the essence of the rule, such as, you know, this is the rule that my manager told me to put in on November 19th or whatever else. So there's a lot of capability in that rule editing UI to simplify the noise, so you're not dealing with a lot of things that you don't want to deal with, to help you to name rules. We also got some feedback on some of the fundamental capabilities of the rule issuance language and attribute store. So for example, when you're going into Active Directory and you're pulling out all the token groups that a user's a member of, we had a bunch of users that said, and some smart, you know, AD admins who said, well, wait, if they've authenticated with Curb or Windows authentication, then I already have their security groups. I don't have to go out to AD to get all of their security groups. We've already got a set of SIDs that came in. Why can't I issue claims based on that? So now there's a rule template to say, hey, let you select a group from Active Directory, and then we'll paste that SID into the rule, and then you can issue whatever claim you want based on that SID. So that's a really powerful thing, because it really is performant, because you've already got those SIDs. You're not doing a query out to LDAP. And you can issue any claim you want. So when I see that you're in domain admins, I can turn that around and say that you have the role of purchaser when you're going out to this purchasing application, and put some rich logic in like that. When you are going out to LDAP and you want to query all the groups that a user is a member of, we also realized that we had sort of hard-coded in a format for those groups that were coming back. And that format was simply, you know, essentially the SAM account name for that group. So you know, for domain admins, it was domain admins. But when you're sending this across trust boundaries, there's a lot of folks that are interested in qualifying that group name by the domain that it actually came from, especially if you represent multiple domains going out to this partner. So now we can do things like, I want it formatted with the domain name in it, so like Fabricam, WAC, domain admins, or I want it formatted like an email address, the same way your UPN would be formatted. So for me, that's, you know, mattsd@microsoft.com. I can have domain admins@microsoft.com. And you can make all these choices as an admin based on the relationship that you actually have with that partner, or based on the requirements that you know that that, you know, relying party application has for the claims that are coming into it. So with that, you have a lot more rich capabilities for defining how groups appear to your partners and how they appear to the relying party applications that are relying on the claims that are coming from your service. Beyond that, we have a set of improvements, you know, beyond those user experience pieces. Probably the biggest thing we wanted to improve in RC, and we put a lot of effort into, was troubleshooting the system. When you're dealing with claims and you're dealing with partners and complex agreements that you have across partners and multiple applications with different requirements, you can run into a lot of situations where through, you know, no fault of your own or through no fault of the relying party admin of their own, there's some sort of mismatch in expectations across because there's so many parties involved. And so it's very important to be able to go through and diagnose, okay, well, let's make sure that the federation service isn't where the problem is, and make sure that as the admin, you haven't misunderstood what a relying party needs or what, say, a claims provider is going to provide you in terms of claims. So we've added very, very rich tracing. And it turned out in beta 2, we had some tracing in beta 2. You would have to go in and enable that tracing by editing a configuration file and restarting the service. What we've done is we've integrated with the Windows tracing framework, the ETW tracing framework, so that now you can bring up Event Viewer, go down to the ADFS node, you should say show diagnostic and analysis logs, and then you go down to that node and you can enable that log straight from the Event Viewer. And you then start to get all of the traces of the system as requests are coming in to the Federation service. So I can start to get very detailed traces on the policy decisions that were made with my rules. So for example, we do rule by rule, we do tracing. So we could say, here are the input claims to this rule, the rule actually executed, and here's how things changed after that rule was executed. So I can see if, did I not formulate that rule correctly? Did I possibly mistype the value that I was expecting from my claims provider or that I wanted to provide my relying party? Furthermore, for major sort of diagnostic events like failures to issue a token or user errors that could be prevented by admin action, we've actually revamped a lot of our eventing. Scrubbed the text to make it very usable by an admin who's trying to do some diagnosis, and the admin can now go in and have an end-to-end tracing all the way through a request to see exactly what failed and why, and see a set of recommended user actions to address that failure. So, for example, when a user goes in and say is trying to get a token for a relying party application, if they get a failure, they'll get what we call an activity ID, and they can provide that activity ID to the admin, and the admin can actually then search the events that we publish in our eventing node and say, show me every event that corresponds to this activity ID. And they'll get an end-to-end look at all the events that occurred in the process of processing that request. So they can actually see, it turns out that Active Directory was down, or it turns out that we have a misconfigured key in the system. And then they can actually see user actions for recommended ways of resolving that issue. So we've done a lot to improve that after-the-fact diagnosis. We want to take away the noise from the user experience, so that people don't make those mistakes in the first place. But when they inevitably do, because we're all human, you want to make it very, very easy to identify that mistake and say, okay, here's all I need to do to fix that particular thing. So that sort of takes us from the deployment into the authoring of rules, into the addition of additional security features, and also what happens when, oh God, something went wrong. That's a pretty big summary of what we did in RC. We did a lot of little things that are notable and a lot of bug fixes, but those are the major pieces that we put out.
Well, Matt, this was really, really great. And I'm absolutely blown away. I didn't know that there was all this stuff in RC.
There's a lot.
Even though I did hear in the aisle, but I didn't imagine. It's great that you have so many super important features, and I have to say, this is exactly what I would expect from the release candidate of a product. Like, this is exactly the kind of maturity that you would expect from there. And it's great that you have all these very thoughtful things that actually simplifies life for admins in very, very concrete fashion. You allow them to do more, because the stuff about being able to release or not release the token is something that we always spoke about it in theory. And finally being able to do it,
yeah.
And that's awesome.
It's cool to see in action. And one thing, we've taken a lot of customer feedback over the course of the RC milestone, but we're even more eager to get customer feedback on RC, because there are some new features in RC, and we're looking forward to hearing that from customers as well.
That's great. The enterprise scenarios are just great. Like what you described about handling the key of the load balancer, the rollover of a cert, I've personally been on a customer a few years ago in which they were making heavy use of certificates. And the week, every couple of years in which they had their certificates expire was like a crazy anthill.
Right.
Everybody running everywhere, phones ringing all the time. And what you described is just perfect for solving this. So thank you so much for giving us such a great overview. And well then, we'll see you at RTN.
Sounds good.
Thank you.